today, the air quality in Santa Cruz and in San Francisco is the worst in the world. And this isn't the first time this has happened in the last 365 days. And the fires are very, very close to Tassajara, you know, within 7 miles. And there's only a few people there. And they're very close to where you live, and they're very close to where I live. And the fires, you know, if it were only the fires, that would be one thing. But keeping the windows closed because of the fires increases the carbon dioxide in the home, and is riskier for our not getting COVID-19. So even if there weren't fires or COVID-19 to worry about, by now our financial situations are not exactly, you know, 6 months ago. And a lot of our loved ones are in trouble or in danger. And you can feel things changing. I mean, that eerie lightning storm on Thursday, it felt like we were on the angry red planet. The whole sky was lighting up with lightning. It didn't feel like anything from Earth. And because of that, my body had an instant reaction of anxiety, which is only getting worse as the air quality decreases and my ability to breathe gets smaller. And so it's quite the perfect storm of conditions in which we can feel our mortality, our fear of pain and suffering, and a whole bunch of other things. Besides, you know, there are glimmerings of hope within that fear, but there's also fear that we may not be able to realize those hopes. So all of that is coming up today. And I don't know, I might be the only one who's feeling this, but if this is actually relevant to you, could you please give me a thumbs up? you just gave me like 10 thumbs up. Kathy gave me all her fingers up. But so I don't want to speak as some priest from on high right now. I want to speak as a fellow human being practicing with you. And I happen to have a responsibility to keep speaking about the Dharma because I so vowed, you know, as part of Dharma transmission, but even before that, that I would do that and try to help wake up for the benefit of all beings. That's my vow. My basic vow is, okay, I'm going to wake up for the benefit of all beings. But my basic feeling about that and about giving lectures and about really being able to help in this situation is dun, 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 dun. So my basic feeling, you know, every time you sit on the Buddha seat, no one is ready to do that. Unless his name begins with the B, goes on to have you like a UDDH and ends with an A. But also, there's nothing that we can say or do that will actually get rid of this situation and its complexities. And so I think for just like take a breath in and take a breath out and face that. Because I don't think that helping will have to do with turning away. So just, I'm seeing you, which is smiles, which is great. But I'm also face that fear and that anxiety and the kind of changeability of the world which even 8 months ago seemed like it would go on for a while, and now I'm not sure. So, you know, and there's a resistive quality to this fear or anxiety I discover, that it's not like something that I can, even in Zazen, if I come to an experience of emptiness, which we can do. But even if that happens, if I don't simultaneously, you know, like as soon as I get up, face the fear, face the situation, it feels like I'm cheating. It feels like I'm misusing the power of practice, unless I'm really with what's happening. So I want to give it its due this evening and just say that facing fear is a bodhisattva practice. It's a practice of waking up for the benefit of all beings. If we don't wake up, we can't face our fear. And if we wake up, we must face our fear in the situation. So I noticed that facing the fear doesn't resolve the fear, but it does give me presence in the moment, which is a kind of resolution for that moment, which again, I have to be careful not to misuse, not to generalize the saving grace that is living in the present moment, to think that the problem is actually solved, because it isn't. I'd approach privileges people who practice over people who don't. And so I don't really want to privilege myself as a practitioner in that way, although I do want to practice and do take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha to face that fear. I just had a huge flash of Catherine Vanis. You know, Catherine and I started our yoga practices together, and we would go visit Judith Lassiter and a couple of other teachers in San Francisco when she was living there. And when I was Shuso in 1987, Catherine was the Tanto at Tassajara. And so we had a long relationship before we ever did the teachery stuff. And so I remember one time, I don't know if you remember how terrifying of a driver Catherine was. She was horrible. So she would be, you know, it would be like, oh, we're on Market Street. It's a 5 mile downhill. Let's coast. You know, and she would like, I swear the car became narrower to go between two cars to go faster than everyone else. I swear the car shape changed shape like in those cartoons. And I was like this. And Catherine just looked at me and she had this big smile. Like she was enjoying it. And I said, Catherine Thanis, I am terrified. Would you please slow down? And she just smiled. And then later we had a conversation about fear anxiety. And she said, one of the things that she said at that time was, you don't have to look. And then she laughed. And, but we do have to look. We do have to look. And what we have to look at in particular, that's very resistant, so that looking doesn't actually cure it in an ongoing way, is the five major fears, which are death, like in the car with Catherine Thanis, illness, like COVID-19, unusual states of mind, like dementia, or will anxiety make me stupider so I'll actually be less good at responding, shopping, or whatever I need to do. Loss of livelihood or reputation. and of course, public speaking, which also is a fear of exposure or showing our vulnerability or our humanness. And so those are the five fears that the Buddha named. And still every bit as good as they were at that time. And there's a resistive quality to them. So you can resolve them in the moment through practicing, but then either you'll realize pretty soon that they're not actually fixed, or else they'll come back, and sometimes just come back under another guise. And in these perfect storm conditions, we can get to the place where the physiology of the body switches over to the sympathetic nervous system, or we even begin to shut down. So those are danger signals. If that's happening to you, see a professional. I mean it. Do you swear? Do you vow that you will see a professional if you start shutting down? Please hold up your right hand and yeah. Okay. Thank you. Okay. Because we all can use a little bit of help. Thank you. Yeah, so Rachel, thanks. So, but those moments of anxiety or the bottom dropping out can come with any of those fears. And of those fears, the fear of death is the stickiest. So for instance, in the yoga teachings, the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali says that abhinivesha, or the fear of death, is, even the sages have it, that it's very, very sticky. And fear of death can also include, like, for instance, if you're in a state of trauma, any little change can put you outside of your window of tolerance, because we're already traumatized, which then means that we can go numb or disassociated or paralyzed or just lose our ability to be ourselves because we're in a different nervous system. So we have three possibilities for our response. They're modulated by the vagus nerve, which goes from basically the head to the heart and the heart to the head. And the vagus nerve branches out, and you might want to read like Stephen Porges's book or Stanley Rosenberg's books or somebody who talks about this polyvagal theory. It's also on the internet in the form of easy to digest videos. But what's interesting about it is that the posture that we use, particularly the Abhaya Mudra posture or the Buddha Mudra posture that we use for sitting, actually put the vagus nerve into an origin and emphasize the part of the vagus nerve and vagal response that allow us to stay ourselves. Okay, so we've got various protective positions that we do. These are bodily gestures that human beings do. So, of course, we're not discussing aggression, although sometimes aggression comes out as a sort of disguise of fear. So in aggression, usually you make a bigger posture. And you make a bigger posture or a posture that's ready to act, or in some cases ready to flee, fight and flight, is one of the nervous systems, and that's one of the vagal responses. It's modulated through emotions, which can be reached through thoughts, through facial expression, through physical gesture, or through events that we perceive as outside of ourselves and are scared of. So we can, our desire to flee can be triggered in a variety of ways. And then there's an extreme, like when even fleeing doesn't work, which is called shutting down or becoming paralyzed. It's what, like if a rabbit's about to die while being hunted, it'll just shut down like this and go completely paralyzed or even play dead. And that's a capability of our nervous system as well. And it happens to us when we're outside of our window of tolerance for an extended period of time. And then there's the social engagement part of the nervous system, which is frontal. So this is the part where, like, if you're actually in a house in which you can hug somebody, that's actually an appropriate response for a bodhisattva because it activates that frontal social engagement system. And another thing that we can do is to look at each other and appreciate each other's faces and to smile and to bow, because that's a touch as well. So these are very simple triggers that we can use to bring ourselves back. In the situation of COVID-19, in the situation of the political climate, or whatever part of it is actually worst for us. So basically, we swing back and forth between emptiness and form, of course. If we want to remedy our fear, we can sit zazen and come to a state of emptiness, meaning that nothing is certain, everything changes, including this. And in zazen, as soon as we do this and sit up, that's a mudra that seals a meditative posture in which form and emptiness are united, and in which we can develop a framework, a physical and physiological framework that's upright enough, open enough, and deep enough to hold anything, quite literally. And this is something that Catherine and I used to talk about a lot. More on that later, maybe in the Q&A if someone asks me about it. I talked to Dana Takagi a little bit about this, and I think some of it is in my ode to Catherine in that book. Right? So we can experience that emptiness in zazen, but again, I say, let's not misuse that ability to experience emptiness and use emptiness as kind of another retreat or another way to disassociate. So with form, the basic practice is do not withdraw and become paralyzed in a state of fear. You know, you can find ways to decrease the stress by supporting ourselves when we're scared or anxious, by nourishing ourselves. Why do we do this? Well, it's because the emotions all are all signals that have been developed for millions of years. Like, for instance, the message of anger is boundaries, needs, respect. But the message of fear is support. Support me. I need something solid and stable. That's the message of fear. So like, for instance, if you're standing on the edge of a cliff and you have that giddy feeling, you'll immediately put your foot down or hold on to something. So we need a rock. You know, we need We need something that won't give way. Of course, there isn't anything that won't give way. So then what we need is the fact that there isn't anything. Okay. So that's called insight. So we have to face and name the fear. And as I said, that we can also recognize that when we begin to separate, and we can prompt ourselves to think, as a bodhisattva, what support do I need to actually turn towards this instead of away from it? Because denial works and helps by giving us space and time. But if we maintain it too long, the deeper physiological processes do take over and we do numb ourselves and become disassociated. And this is just human. This is what we do. So we have a time limit. Denying has a time limit as a strategy, and it also tends to allow the kind of the most unconscious parts of ourselves to. So, if we, for instance, deny that COVID-19 is inequally affecting, impacting people who are rich and people who are poor. We can deny that. But then the worst parts of ourselves, as in whatever privilege we have, will take over, because those are those will become defaults, and so the deeper causes and stresses won't get addressed. So eventually we have to face it. Well, how do we face it? Well, what I would like to suggest is that the intelligence of the head and of words will not really help us face it. Although they are good, good tools to name it and bring our attention to it, even insight helps the intelligence of the head. But unless it's moistened with the intelligence of the heart, that insight won't stick or have anywhere to go in our lives. So what I'd like to suggest is that we use the intelligence of the heart and use the intelligence of the head as a tool for the intelligence of the heart. So no amount of understanding pros and cons will help us understand this situation. We have to work with our sense of perspective and with our sense of heart. So, like, for instance, you know, have you ever heard the phrase friendliness, compassion, empathetic joy, and equanimity? You probably have heard it because, again, this is like a KT basic, like, I love those four immeasurables. Those are the best, the Mahabrahma Vihara's rule, yay, kind of thing, that she really loved them, as do I. You know, because they really help. So equanimity, which is actually the fruit of the other three, is something that we need right now. So we better practice all of them. So equanimity will allow us to, there's fear. Equanimity allows us to accept and acknowledge it as it is. The same as if we said, there's toast. Right? So that's equanimity, but that maybe there's something between where we are now and equanimity that we could actually think about for a moment. So friendliness is the beginning of this. I would say that all the four immeasurables, when we use them as tools to work with fear, have the taste of friendliness, so that if we study friendliness, the other ones will eventually develop. Just like all the precepts have the taste of non-harming. So if we study non-harming, we'll genius-like develop all the precepts. If we study friendliness, all of the Mahabrahma Viharas will come to life. So friendliness is the ability to see something as it is, to understand its difference from other things, and to accept it and remain curious and connected. Okay, so that's friendliness. So friend progresses to compassion, which is to recognize and not disassociate from pain. Fear is painful. It's a painful state projected into the future. So the usual Zen talk would say, just stay in the present. I'm not saying just stay in the present. I'm saying fear is a feature of this situation. But we do have our fear in the present. But if we're friendly with the fear, we will be in the present. We don't have to sit there and think, stay in the present, stay in the present. You know, because that won't help. We actually have to develop the mood and the physiology of the present, which means connection. Meaning, connection. Okay. Those are the things that we have to be with. So I'd like to give meaning for the pain, the painful aspect of fear, by saying that friendliness with pain is called compassion. Friendliness with pleasure, especially the pleasure of others that they have that you don't have, is empathetic joy. And compassion and empathetic joy are the content of the meditation on friendliness that culminates in equanimity. Perfect equanimity, perfectly faced. But even being friendly with it decreases the stress level of the fear to the place where one of our other nervous systems can begin to take over, where the vagus nerve will be other messages that we can notice besides the one of run, hide, flee, or shut down. And it would actually allow us to say this very difficult thing of, I'm scared. Will you help me? Or we're both scared. Can I help you and can you help me? For me, this is like the worst thing ever to have to say this thing. Like I was in some very bad accidents in 2008 and 2010. So I had traumatic brain injury, multiple traumatic brain injury. And so I was dizzy, and also I lost a lot of language. I lost fluency. I lost a lot of physical stuff, and I couldn't cross streets. And I was 56 years old. I had to turn to somebody and say, would you help me cross the street? I'm scared. And inside I'm going, no, no. Your adults do that, you know, but I had to do it and it helped me. So, and what I found out is that compassion arises when we admit our vulnerability in a straightforward facing it kind of way. So the kid with the baseball cap and the jeans slung around his low hips and so on said, sure, I'll help you. Okay, there's a car coming. Okay, now there's no car. We can go. Are you okay? Do you need some help? You know? And I go, oh, what a kind kid. And then, you know, he kind of turns to me and he says, you're okay now, right? And I realized that it was the intimacy of facing the fear and admitting it to him that created that opportunity for his compassion. I gave him the gift of fearlessness around me as he was giving me the gift of helping me cross the street. So it's a lesson I won't forget. Anyway, so what I want to say is that this gift of these gifts that we give through the social emotions of friendliness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity turn their investments in the living beauty of impermanence, unidentifiableness, and constant change. So the things that we think of as afflictions that we're scared of when we project them into the future, you know, the underlying uncertainty of not self, ill, and change, you know, those are the afflictions, right? Those are the three big ones. That they actually turn into appreciation. Something more complex than self. Something that's in which the good is precious. And something in which change is imminent. So any time we use the intelligence of the heart, we're investing in the beauty of human life. We're investing in using those qualities of life, of impermanence, ill, and not self, as the letting that allows the beauty of this, of the colors of life to shine through everything that we do. So, you know, okay, if I just have a few minutes, but I want to say two things. These are teachings and quotes from other people. just to get in the mood for Q&A. Okay. So the first one is this section from the Upajatana Sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya. It's called the Five Remembrances, and you probably know them. And my Dharma sister Blanche was extremely fond of these. And Blanche started preparing for death like the day that she got ordained. She was so curious. But these remembrances inspired her. And of course, you've heard them. What's good about them is that they just name the problem that we would otherwise turn away from in fear. I'm just going to say them, okay? I am subject to aging. There's no way to avoid. I'm subject to sickness. There's no way to avoid sickness. I'm subject to death. There's no way to avoid death. Everyone and everything that I love is going to change and separate from me. And my only true possessions, the only thing I can hang on to, are what I do. I cannot escape the consequences of what I do. Okay, so just a sense of direction on this is that my only possession is what I do. And if I am using the intelligence of the heart, if I'm allowing that to be boss and letting the intelligence of the head be the tools for its realization, then everything that comes up is an investment in the growth of my heart and its ability to connect with others. Like another one of Blanche's favorites. Blanche, just to say that when Blanche knew she was about to die, I was her durable power of attorney, and I would visit her every day, and I did finish her Dharma transmissions and stuff, and took care of the important decisions, and supported her family and so on the way she wanted that to be done. And so about every 5 minutes, whenever I was there, Blanche would say, "Promise, promise." And she was trying to get me to promise a couple of things. One was that I would say certain things and do certain things when she was like 2 days out from dying, you know, a day out from dying, as best I could understand, you know, a few hours from dying, and right at the moment of death. And this is the poem she wanted me to read at her funeral. She had a lot of specifications, like how much dry ice, what kind of flowers, and just anyway, I won't go into it. Anyway, just know that as she got closer and closer to death, these things became more and more of a thing for her. This poem she loved, and this is, of course, Mary Oliver's poem, When Death Comes. And you can use death as a shorthand for all the stuff we're scared of now. When death comes, like the hungry bear in autumn, when death comes and takes all the bright coins from his purse to buy me and snaps the purse shut, when death comes like the measles pox, when death comes like an iceberg between the shoulder blades, I want to step through the door full of curiosity, wondering, what is it going to be like, that cottage of darkness? And therefore, I look upon everything as a brotherhood and a sisterhood. And I look upon time as no more than an idea. And I consider eternity as another possibility. And I think of each life as a flower, as common as a field daisy, and as singular. and each name a comfortable music in the mouth, tending as all music does towards silence. And each body a lion of courage and something precious to the earth. When it's over, I want to say, all my life I was a bride married to amazement. I was the bridegroom taking the world into my arms. When it's over, I don't want to wonder if I've made of my life something particular. I don't want to find myself sighing and frightened or full of argument. I don't want to end up simply having visited this world. So thanks for your patience. Thanks for listening and hearing. And, you know, of course, if you want to say something or if I left something out or, you know, please, the floor is open.
Hi, Vicki.
Ken.
It's good to see you.
Hi.
I appreciate what you said about curiosity. I think that's a very helpful thing for me. I stumble on it from time to time, but a lot of times for me, especially during these times, it feels like the snake in the bamboo tube. I can relax. Sometimes I can find refuge in the present, but then it becomes an endurance test. That's the hardest part for me. That's when I start to get anxious and then I can't get out again. And, yeah.
Yeah, Ken?
Yeah.
It's spelled F-U-N.
Fun?
Find more fun. You know? Not externalized fun. You know? Kind of, F-U-N is also the beginning of functional.
What do you mean by fun with yourself? Like do a crossword puzzle or
no, like you said that as it goes on.
Yeah.
So what that means is that you're being held outside your window of tolerance for too long. And you know, if you had a patient who got with a frozen shoulder and you were moving their arm around. And they were going, oh my God, it's moving, ow. You know, you would stop, you take a different tack, you do like a gentle rhythmic thing, right? That was a little more fun. That's what I mean. It's not very complicated. Gotcha. You know, you have that skill, right? So,
Exactly. What I used to do was like when they would say, my shoulder is really painful. I'd say, well, I can get rid of that. They go, how would you get rid of it? I said, I'll just punch the other arm. And then you think about that one for a change. So sometimes it works. You know?
And then when they left, it was better.
Yeah, it was better. Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
But I can't really do that with myself sometimes. Should I?
I'm asking you to.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. How about this? Pretty please.
I'll try. I mean, I'm all for it. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Pretty please.
You don't have to do that.
Pretty please. You know, just really, I think you have the skill. That's what I mean by the intelligence of the head has to, it's not that you have to change anything, right? Because, you know, what you've done is you've trained yourself to notice those signals in another person. So you know it's possible. Mm-hmm. You know it's possible to respond. So I'm just asking, you know, you're in your apartment like 24/7, 365 right now, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so there isn't anyone else around. So if you don't do that with yourself.
I start talking to myself. It's a little dangerous.
Yeah, just, you know, you're the most interesting thing in the room, really.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. anyone else. Sorry, Ken.
That's all right.
Okay. Yeah. Kathy, yeah.
Yeah, well, a little bit following on what Ken said, I was intrigued by the comment that you made that you called the physiology of the present. And I, that's when I, one of the things I like about these Zoom things is I get my notebook and I start taking notes with
Nintendo. Oh, she's holding me accountable.
And now I'm all, oh boy, I get my notebook. So, you know, I can remember stuff, my dementia. Yeah. That's my dementia. So you said about, you know, we can't just say stay present, which, you know, we tend to think we're supposed to. But right. Point then you said about being in, I forget, I couldn't quite read my writing, the physiology of the present. What yeah. do you mean by?
Yeah. So that what I'm saying is that there are different like windows that go into that access the being in the present. There's different possibilities, different approaches that we can use. Okay, one such approach, and since to soften the skin and be open to touch. Mm. You can't touch in the future or in the past. Mm-hmm. Touch is really immediate. Mm-hmm. You know, so. So anything that you're doing it now. But the thing is to understand that what you're, you know, we usually measure by what our feelings are. But I'm asking you to measure in a different way. I'm asking you to measure by the quality of attentiveness, closeness from the intelligence of the heart. You know, so, It's almost like, you know, let's say, I don't know if this has happened to you during this shelter in place, but quite a lot of times it's dangerous for me as someone with autoimmune things to go to the grocery store. So I end up eating the same thing again and again and again. And then sometimes there's only like, you know, a can of marinated beets that someone gave to me that's been there forever, or, you know, like whatever, you know, until I get to the store or get someone to get me something. And then I have to kind of get interested in that. Mm-hmm. So it's that skill.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we all know what that is, right? Mm-hmm. So that's one entry into the physiology, the endocrine messaging in the body, because that's, we have several messaging systems. That's one of them. And that's mm-hmm. the one I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. Messaging system is accessible. Like even if you just go to the mirror and smile at yourself, mm-hmm. it will begin to be activated. Or if you hug a pillow, mm-hmm. it will begin to be activated. Mm-hmm. Or if you, of course, the classic meditative way to do this is by saying affirmations or repeating or visualizing someone who is wise in our lives or a sorrowless light. We can also access them. That system that way, and it'll give us messages of equanimity, mm-hmm. peace, mm-hmm. which then we can begin to believe it if we have a sustained experience of that. Mm-hmm. And of course, then misuse it, just like we can misuse any medicine. We can become reliant on, you know, having the music on all the time or something like that. But, then it begins to lose its effectiveness. Mm-hmm. But if we become skillful in that and realize that those are just tools to begin to become skillful about maintaining and developing our heart intelligence. Mm-hmm. If we have heart intelligence, we're always supported when we're scared.
Thank you very much. It's- Very helpful.
Thanks.
Vicki.
Pat.
Like any good Zen student, I've found that this sitting practice and, you know, is it taking refuge in emptiness is a pretty good kind of restart button, and is a way for me to generate curiosity where there was fear. But you've got me curious now. How would I know if it's a dissociative characteristic or a wholesome nurturing characteristic? Are there things to look at?
Well, you know, I'm sad to say, but the people around us usually know first.
they know.
Your students will know.
Well, no, I think that's a good answer.
Yeah, your Dharma buddies will definitely know. I mean, we need each other in this situation. But one thing that you can notice is there's a kind of a narrowness of the attention that comes it's like the mental equivalent of overwork. So there's a narrow focus on emptiness that comes when you're overdoing it mentally. And there's a kind of diffuse anything goes kind of feeling about emptiness when you're underworking, you know. So it's like, I think emptiness has a particular, that meditation on emptiness. Actually, I don't really even like the word emptiness. I tend to think of it as a repleteness or a fullness in which impermanence, ill, and not self are full of possibility, developmental possibility for the heart. Mm-hmm. You know, so what happens if I begin to become addicted to emptiness is that either my attention will go very narrow and I'll start getting repetitively focused on emptiness, which means I'm conceptualizing it and damning it with faint praise. Or else I'll kind of go emptiness, you know, and it'll kind of diffuse and it'll just be mush, which means I'm not there. You know, both of those are ways of disassociating, one through overdoing, like people who, like work addicts, and one through underdoing or avoiding. So you'll know if you, just like you know, like if you were practicing walking as a form of exercise, you'd know if you were at a sustainable pace or if you were going too slow to do yourself any good or too quickly to sustain. So you develop it's a pacing sense when you're working physically and physiologically in this way.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Do Zen students go to bed at 7:30 or?
or soon thereafter.
Okay. It's 7:28.
Is there anyone else? Thank you so much, Vicki, for joining us today and giving us such a timely talk and ways to look at this very moment. Right now outside my window, there's this eerie mustard colored glow of the sky that
same here.
I don't think I've ever seen before.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's kind of, you know, the fires have been coming more frequently, lasting longer. just because we're in the middle of a global pandemic doesn't mean that we're not also in the middle of a global climate crisis, you know? So, I'd say there's plenty to be afraid about and plenty of beauty and intentional development. So even in the worst of situations, we can live. So I appreciate you. Thank you, friends. Bodhisattvas.
Thank you so much.
Do you need to chant something or do anything or, you know,
we'll do. May our attention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.